Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder, with excerpts from Yes, a nonprofit independent publisher of solutions journalism. We will resume an article that we started the last time I read with you. The title is How the Puyallup Tribe Increased Police Accountability in Washington, written by Frank Hopper, first published March 11th, 2024. To refresh your memory a little, this article is about families of other police shooting victims and financial support of every federally recognized tribe in Washington state. The Puyallup tribe helped pass the nation's first police accountability bill. A young woman with the last name of Sawyers had been active in the Puyallup tribe, and she was involved in a shooting that happened when the police shot at her in a truck that she was in the driver's seat. It turned out from the medical examiner's report that she was also pregnant at the time. Council members Sylvia Miller and Tim Raynon, along with tribal elder Ramona Bennett and other influential members of the community, began meeting weekly at the Little Wild Wolves Youth Center to plan how the tribe would respond. The birth of Initiative 940. Bennett knew from experience that change would only come about through publicity, cooperation with other groups, and community support. So she recommended they stage a march. On March 16, 2016, Earl led a procession of nearly 300 people from the Puyallup Tribe's administration building to the federal courthouse in downtown Tacoma. To her surprise, many other families of police shooting victims joined them in support. We didn't have any clue until Jackie was killed, that's Jackie Sawyers, that there were so many others out there going through the same thing as we were, Earl remembers. Over time, attendance at the weekly community meetings at the tribe's youth center grew. Families of other police murder victims shared their stories and discussed what they could do to address the problem. One supporter was Rick Williams, the older brother of John T. Williams, who had been shot by Seattle police officer Ian Burke on August 30, 2010. According to Burke, Williams, age 50, was carrying an open pocket knife and refused to drop it. Williams was a seventh-generation master carver of the Ditita tribe who was carving a board as he walked down the street. Dash cam footage of the incident clearly indicated that after Burke exited his patrol car, he almost immediately fired at the nearly blind and partially deaf Williams. King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg announced he could not charge Burke with murder due to a clause in state law enacted in 1986 during the height of the crack cocaine epidemic that said unless it can be proven a police officer acted with evil intent or malice, they cannot be prosecuted for killing suspects. Since malice is a mental state, it is nearly impossible to prove its presence in a court of law, giving police in Washington nearly complete immunity to kill suspects. Rick Williams had since been working to change the law. He campaigned and collected signatures for Washington State Initiative 873, known as the John T. Williams Bill. It was written by police reform advocate Lisa Hayes after the unjustified Seattle police shooting of Shay Taylor in February 2016. The initiative failed to get enough signatures to be put on the ballot, but later, because the template the families of the Puyallup community meetings used to draft Initiative 940. Along with the families of many other police shooting victims and the financial support of every federally recognized tribe in Washington state, the Puyallup tribe successfully gathered 360,000 signatures to get the initiative on the ballot. And in 2018, Washington voters passed Initiative 940 into law. How the new law affected the police killing of Manuel Ellis. Manuel Ellis died in 2020 while Tacoma police held him face down on the ground, put a bag over his head, kneeled on his neck, causing him to die of hypoxia or lack of breath, just as in the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. If his death had happened before the passage of Initiative 940, the three officers responsible for his death, Matthew Collins, Christopher Burbank, and Timothy Rankine, would never have been charged with a crime or put on trial. Due to the new law, however, Collins and Burbank were charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter, and Rankine was charged with manslaughter. All three officers were acquitted on December 21, 2023, by a mostly white jury, and the city of Tacoma paid them $500,000 each to resign. This outcome is considered perverse by Ellis's family and supporters. Chester Earle, Salyer's cousin, feels the issue of white privilege played a major role in the verdict. He thinks the white jurors had no experience dealing with police racism and violence. He feels they probably believe the police are always right. You got to remember, all we've been able to do with 940 is give the prosecutors the opportunity to charge and convict and take them to court. We can't make prosecutors argue it in a certain way, he explains. The fight for true police reform will likely take years and will require a major shift in how the public feels about the role of law enforcement in our society. Salyer's tragic murder, however, caused a major step in that direction, according to her uncle, James Rideout. What makes me most proud, he says, is she brought the best out in me to do something that has never been done in the history of the United States, and that's to change this law for the protection of our future generations. And I thank her, and it'll be a lifetime before I can tell her. You changed our entire tribe and community forever, and you will always, always be remembered. We will never forget you. Your life mattered. About the author, Frank Hopper, who is of the tribe Tlingit, is a freelance native journalist born in Juneau, Alaska, now living in Tacoma, Washington. His work appears in Last Real Indians, The Stranger, and Indian Country Today. His self-titled YouTube channel features videos about Native issues. He can be reached at tigerskin62@gmail.com. Next, from the opinion section, Murmurations, Wisdom from Women Changemakers. This was written by Kristen Zimmerman and Shauna Wakefield and Rufaro Guarada. It was first published March 26, 2024. The drawing that accompanies this is a colorful yellow artistic example of a sunflower that is surrounded by the shapes of like the cells that you see in a beehive. And then there are circles that are yellow with black stripes on them, depicting bees of a sort. The sunflower has a dark center to it. It has yellowish orange petals all around that circle, and then many different colored petals beyond that. A note from Adrian Mari Brown. Shauna Wakefield is passionate about collaborative work and collective thinking, as well as a member of the Fire Ensemble, which was the first choir to perform my debut public musical ritual, To Feel a Thing, a ritual for emergence. Shauna and the co-authors of this piece, Kristen Zimmerman and Rufaro Guarada, are the core team of Root, Rise, Pollinate. In the summer of 2023, we at Root, Rise, Pollinate began to gather feminist changemakers from across the globe into an embodied storytelling project to tell the story of the future. We invited them to play with us and bring their hopes, love, and visions into our virtual circle in multiple sessions. Together, during one of the sessions, we wove a particular story, a fable, excerpted below, across time zones, cultures, and generations. And then there's a little grayish-colored rectangle here on the screen, and it has within it this part that I'm going to read to you. And so the other children asked, well, could we be visitors? Is there a way to share this place that wouldn't intrude? Ursula thought about it, and she looked at the trees and the path, and she asked Water, and Water said, yes, please bring the visitors. Remind them to bring their heart, make their offerings, and connect in their own ways. Yes, bring them in. So the children went to this place, and they saw the beautiful little stream. As they sat, everybody was very quiet until Ursula turned and asked, "Is everybody okay?" And Sister said, "Yes, but somehow it's like we didn't know what water was before, and now we see her in a different way. We see more than we ever could." And they thanked her for bringing them to this special place. That's the end of the little story. Going on with the article, the deliciously non-linear process of weaving this story together allowed us to feel, see, taste, and touch the world we long for our descendants, ancestors, and yes, ourselves. Speculative embodied storytelling is especially important now, given the level of uncertainty, conflict, and collective grief many of us are experiencing. Climate disruption has us literally navigating uncharted waters and unprecedented weather. Powerful new technologies for healing and war are evolving faster than we can grasp or govern them. Conflict is pervasive and escalating. Various anxieties haunt us and are amplified. Disconnections, isolation, loneliness, the specter of new deadly diseases, eco-anxiety, economic uncertainty, disregard for the life and well-being of the perceived other, displacement and lack of safe, consistent housing, concerns for our families and communities' futures. Yet all is not lost. We need not brace ourselves and hold our collective breath. Instead, we can take low and slow breaths into our bellies, knowing that more people are remembering our right relationship to each other, to water, earth, fire, and air, sensing this is a crucial moment to leap into ways of being that foster repair, interconnection, and mutual thriving. The paradox of this time feels both new and ancient. What might it look like to belong to ourselves, each other, and Earth unconditionally? How might we remember what we've forgotten? How do we sit in paradox and use it to evolve together? Women leaders, organizers, and healers have helped their communities contend with these questions for generations. Root, Rise, Pollinate started gathering such feminist changemakers, whom we call pollinators, early in the COVID-19 pandemic because we knew they could support and mutual thriving in the middle of collapse. You are tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes. Now, years later, we find it even more important to commit to collective practices that generate hope, love, care, and community. Our current work in progress, Reports from a Revolution of Being, uses embodied storytelling to help pollinators be present in paradox, dream together, and apply those dreams daily in service of our collective evolution. Three core practices are emerging as essential to this evolution: courageous presence, radical imagination, and embodied adaptation. Practice 1, courageous presence. I don't like the word resistance. I like the word courageous presence. What is courageous presence? It means you've really accepted the challenge given to you and you have developed through it. Surrounded by people that understand the different parts that feed the whole soul and strengthen the body and mind for that challenge. Elder Kathy Sanchez, Tewa Women United. The practice of speculative, embodied storytelling calls us to be present with the world as it is right now. This isn't easy, but it's powerful. As human beings and activists, various habits protect us from seeing and experiencing the muchness of the world. Repetitive, unconscious behaviors like, but not limited to, retreating into or entrenching in that which is most familiar, or overindulgence in any number of things. The unconsciousness with which we engage in these habits also separates us from our core power. We lose our ability to recognize and exercise our agency to face what is difficult and make choices to move away from the status quo towards something more hopeful, joyful, and rooted in love with courage. In embodied storytelling, we begin and end story circles with breath, body-based movement, and questions such as, how is your heart today? By doing so, we bring our whole selves, heart, mind, body, spirit, forward in preparation for the stories we might weave. We practice courageous presence, rooted in love of ourselves, our people, and places, while opening to the complexities of our present conditions and the possibility to transform them. Practice 2. Visioning the Arc. Our work as a movement is to create the conditions in which governance is loving. We don't just want loving organizations, we want loving communities. We want the bloody state of the world to be loving, which is ultimately where we are trying to go with power. That was written by Jessica Horn. Storytelling is the foundation of transformative strategy. It enables us to envision new, unexpected possibilities rooted in powerful ancient truths. Pollinators weave a story together, generating ideas and energies that are hard to access when we are in more linear planning or evaluation modes. Through this playful practice, we often surface key elements of vision, purpose, and strategies faster than when in those more linear modes. We connect the many layers of ourselves and our worlds with more ease. Some of the most powerful stories we created brought in the complexities of life rather than a sanitized utopia. Through this practice, we are seeding and growing power that is rooted in our imaginations, our interconnectedness, and the things we love. Practice 3. Embodied Adaptation. The power of this work is as a driver of movement building, so that we do it in a way that fuels and strengthens the collective. That quote by Shireen Esoff. A revolution of being is about embodying the change we want to see in the world, without compartmentalizing the change. A revolution of being enables us to live wholeheartedly with purpose as our imperfect selves in our imperfect world. Practice is the path. As we engage in a revolution of being, we develop our capacity to keep our visions alive, to establish courageous presence, and to make choices and adjustments in response to inevitable change based on what is really important. We expect to learn and practice as we go. Stewards of the Future. Each of us is trying to build a better future through collective learning. Each of us is both a learner and a teacher. Pam Kai Mela said that. As stewards of the future, we are part of a longer arc, connected to our ancestors and descendants. A revolution of being will look different in each place and with each group of people, but it will share some similarities. The deep love for home, an unshakable sense of belonging, and an awareness of our interconnectedness with all living things. Join us in discovering a revolution of being. About the author. Kristen Zimmerman is a writer, artist, and world builder based in Oakland, California. They are currently an adjunct professor at California State University East Bay, teaching narrative illustration and comics. They hold an MFA in comics from California College of Arts and a BA from Brown University. Kristen co-founded and directed numerous projects that apply world-building practices to real-world transformation, including Root, Rise, Pollinate, the Transitions Network, Decolonize Race, Movement Strategy Center, Youth in Focus, and Community Lore. Their writing and comics have been published by Autostraddle, The Reverb, Movement Strategy Center, Electric Squeak, the Gender and Development Journal, and other outlets. Rifara Guarada is committed to a world animated by Onhu Ubuntu, the understanding that collective and individual well-being are one and the same. She is a mama, writer, International Coaching Federation certified coach, facilitator, and organizer with more than 15 years working for gender justice, migrant rights, African-led solutions for Africans, and utilizing art and cultural expression as conduits for healing, liberation, and joy. Rufaro is co-director for Root Rise Pollinate, founder and principal of Pamuyu, a coaching and consulting practice, and co-founded Culture Shift initiatives Wakanda Dream Lab and Reset. Rufaro is home in Zimbabwe, Oakland, and Sacramento, California, with Sangha on the dance floor and among creatives and those who strive for liberation of all peoples. And the third author, Shauna Wakefield, is committed to cultivating joyful, trusting relationships for loving power. She is a facilitator, teacher, and strategist who helps social justice leaders and their groups infuse complex work and lives with care, compassion, and ease. She is a mama, embodiment practitioner, and adjunct professor on gender, race, power, and international development. She has a master's degree in public administration from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. She worked for Oxfam for a decade, the United Nations, and for smaller grassroots organizations working for immigrant rights, gender, racial, and economic justice. She speaks English. Finishing up, we come to an article in the Explainer section, "We Are All Responsible for Making Bathrooms Safer." This was written by Kate Sosin, published March 22, 2024. A photograph shows the door to a restroom with the blue sign on it that we're so accustomed to, and the symbol on it says inclusive. It has the symbol for a person in a wheelchair and the symbol for men, women, and non-binary people. For many trans and non-binary people, bathrooms can be complicated places to navigate, a fact highlighted by the death of 16-year-old Nex Benedict in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is far from an outlier when it comes to failing to provide safe and equitable bathrooms for transgender people. According to the Movement Advancement Project, which tracks LGBTQ+ policy, 13 states have a policy that prevents transgender people from safely or legally using public bathrooms. But data shows that even in states with trans-friendly policies, transgender and non-binary people report high rates of harassment in public bathrooms. Advocates say everyday people can have a big impact in interrupting discrimination in gendered restrooms. Here's how anyone can help prevent abuse. Acknowledge that bathrooms can be scary and help locate safe options. Sex-segregated restrooms have historically been a hostile space for Tat Bellamy Walker, a Seattle-based journalist and Black, gender-fluid trans person. In graduate school and at journalism internships, they had to go far out of their way to find all-gender single-stall restrooms they could use safely. You never forget being told you don't belong in a restroom. You never forget not having a place to dispose of sanitary products if you're on your period in the men's bathroom, Bellamy Walker said. It's just clear you do not belong in public spaces. Allies can help tremendously by locating and pointing out gender-neutral bathrooms to friends or family who might need them. This is especially important for people planning events or parties. Make sure your space has safe bathrooms. Offer to be a bathroom buddy to your trans and non-binary friends. Carrie Soto, a South Dakota parent of a transgender kid, said she lives by the mantra, "See something, say something." That means speaking up when there is bullying and harassment and volunteering to accompany a trans, non-binary friend or family member when they have to head into a public bathroom. Validate a trans person's fears and anxiety about the situation, Soto said. If my daughter uses a gendered restroom and feels anxious, I go with. Make trans and non-binary people welcome if you see them in bathrooms. It may seem obvious, but transgender health advocates Jamison Green notes this step can really help trans people feel safe. Consider first that according to 2015 U.S. Transgender Survey, 59% of trans people avoided using a public restroom due to fear of harassment. Data from 2022 found that 6% of trans people said they were physically or verbally attacked while trying to use a bathroom, while 4% were denied access to a bathroom. If you see someone who you clock as trans or non-binary, just smile or pay them a non-provocative compliment. Wish them a good day or good evening and move on, Green said. Of course, that only goes for the women's room. In the men's room, talking is extremely rare. Green recommends that cisgender people offer a kind, silent nod. Ask for more gender-neutral options. 22 states and Washington, D.C. allow residents to opt for X gender markers on their IDs in addition to selecting M or F. Still, in every state, regardless of laws, most bathrooms in government buildings, schools, businesses, places of worship, and cultural institutions are gendered. Advocates say people can help change this by simply asking businesses and building owners for more options to accommodate all genders. Advocacy is the most important part of the fight for transgender rights, Lambda Legal notes in its guide to restrooms. And if employers adopt pro-trans policies proactively instead of waiting for a transgender person to pave the way, there's much less chance of having problems down the line. Try to leave single-stall, gender-neutral bathrooms free unless you need them. The internet is full of rants, not appropriate for a news article, about people using the only single-stall, gender-neutral bathrooms available not for safety, but for, well, pooping. As a result, gender-neutral bathrooms, especially in airports, are almost always occupied. There are many reasons why a cisgender person might need a single-occupancy bathroom: accessibility, illness, childcare, and yes, even a little more privacy. Just like accessible stalls, it's a kindness to leave gender-neutral restrooms unoccupied when you don't need them. This story was originally published by the 19th and is reprinted here as part of Yes Participation in the 19th News Network. You have been tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona, listening to excerpts from Yes. I'm your volunteer reader from Flagstaff, Deborah McFadder. Thanks a lot for listening.